stay tuned for the Jordan Journal with Howard Jordan.
People might have read the New York Times a few days ago, talked about whether the U.S. should bail out Puerto Rico. I could not help when I read these things. All of a sudden, Bill O'Reilly is talking about Puerto Rico and comparing it to Greece. I have never seen so much coverage of the Puerto Rican experience as I have this week in the various publications, all geared toward making the Puerto Rican people look like deadbeats that don't pay their bills. I even have my students asking me, oh, you people are having problems paying bills. Now, sometimes we have our problems paying rent, but there's a big difference between that and $73 billion. And I could not think of a better person to talk about this. And basically, is it mismanagement or is it a product of American colonialism? And I'm joined online by the author of The War Against All Puerto Ricans, Revolution and Terror in American Colony. He's a graduate of Harvard University and Yale Law School and served as a New York State Assemblyman from 1997 to 2001. He was also the editorial director of El Diario La Prensa, the largest Spanish language newspaper. I was flipping the channel the other day and I saw him on C-SPAN as well. The book has become number one on Amazon, so it's rare that you have books on Puerto Rico become number one, folk. Not that many people have that recognition of our reality. Welcome to the show, Nelson Dennis.
Howard, thanks for having me on. And happy July 4th weekend to everyone.
I don't celebrate those things, but that's okay. maybe we could start, Nelson, by sharing with us, what is exactly going on in Puerto Rico? Because we're getting so many different interpretations of what's going on, from its Puerto Rican mismanagement to the fact that it's American government to blame. How did we get in this situation, $73 billion debt?
I'll try my best because I'm not an economist either, but there's are some, at the end of the day, it has to do with some numbers. So there's some different opinions and there is plenty of blame to go around. It's not as if the ostensible two-party system in Puerto Rico did not contribute to it, because Puerto Rico has an unusually robust public sector. It currently has, in a population of 3.6 million people, it has 78 towns, 78 municipalities, each of which has a mayor. So if you look at the population of 3.6, that's in the area of the population of, say, Los Angeles. So a bit more than the population of Brooklyn, a little less than Los Angeles. Well, Brooklyn doesn't have 78 mayors. So in Puerto Rico, you have 78 mayors, each of whom then has appointments. And very often, unfortunately, those mayors are putting family and friends on the payroll. So there's an element of reality, a reality check that has to be taken. But there's something deeper beyond that. It's not just they've been mismanaging the funds and they're not like Detroit. It's not that simple. The underlying relationship between the United States and Puerto Rico is what's been driving this for over a century. Puerto Rico does not have all the financial instrumentalities that the municipalities do or the states in New York. So when people try to compare the public debt of Puerto Rico to that of the states, you're not comparing apples and apples. You're comparing apples and colonies, and that doesn't work because Puerto Rico doesn't have even any of the sovereign powers that even a state has or a municipality. It can't declare bankruptcy. It can't conduct its own financial affairs. Puerto Rico is specifically prohibited from maintaining any independent trade relations, or even as an island in the middle of the ocean, its own shipping. So that is a foundational, fundamental fact that has inhibited Puerto Rico from maybe being able to develop its own economy, because it's prohibited from having its own economy. And any economic measures that have been instilled in this colony have been of a short-term tax abatement nature, where they give a tax break to a foreign, i.e. United States corporation, the most recent of which was 936. And the Puerto Ricans rise to the occasion, man. I don't know if you knew this, Howard, but all the Viagra, you know, it sounds fun, right? But all the Viagra that was consumed in North America was produced in one factory in the town of Barceloneta. And it was known as Ciudad Viagra. That's what the people were calling it. It was an amazing success story. This was produced for about 10 years out of that town. So Puerto Rico has a record of being able to rise to the highest levels of productivity and even cutting edge industrial technology. But that 936 was withdrawn. That's IRS code 936 for the listeners. Was providing a corporate tax abatement mainly to pharmaceutical companies. And at one point, Howard, Puerto Rico, until 2006, was producing, listen to this statistic, 25% of the entire world's pharmaceutical drugs shipments. 25% of all pharmaceutical drugs produced and distributed throughout the planet were being made in the island of Puerto Rico. That's how productive the island can be. But what's happened is that 117 years ago, Puerto Rico had its legs taken out from under it, and they've been replaced by a series of crutches ever since. And that doesn't work. Puerto Rico needs its legs back so that it can develop its own economy. To apply that to the cabotage law, in 1920, the Merchant Marine Act of 1920, Section 27, which otherwise known as the Jones-Shafroth Act, specifically prohibit Puerto Rico from having its own shipping industry. And what happens now is the majority of the products that come into Puerto Rico, imports or exports, they have to be offloaded in Jacksonville, Florida, off any foreign boat. So if you have cars from Japan, motors from Germany, medicine or drugs from Canada, food from South America, all of it has to go to Jacksonville, Florida, be offloaded off of the original boat from Germany, Japan, or wherever else, and then reloaded all over again into an American fleet vessel that's owned and operated and crewed by U.S. nationals. Not Puerto Ricans, by U.S. People. And so it creates about a minimum of about 50,000 jobs in Jacksonville, Florida, but not one job in Puerto Rico. And these are jobs that should exist in Puerto Rico. It's like a high-class mafia shakedown protection racket in Jacksonville, Florida. So when we're looking at the public debt, one thing is to say, well, there's money going in, and these are bondholders, and then they have to be paid back. But you have to understand that the genesis of this, the reason we've gotten to this, is because of this dysfunctional relationship. And I'll leave you with one last fact, Howard, and I know that it's too many facts and figures, but just a real quick one. By way of context, the public debt of Puerto Rico, one of the major ways that you do it is you compare it on a per capita basis and in terms of the debt to the gross domestic product, because that's how you contextualize how much real debt you have. The GDP of Puerto Rico last year was about $104 billion, and the public debt is $73 billion. So debt to GDP ratio of 70%. It's roughly about $20,000 to $21,000 of debt for every person on the island. A 70% GDP ratio, debt ratio. But in the United States, they keep comparing it to the debt of every state. But as I said at the outset, Puerto Rico is not a state, and nor does it have any of the powers of the state. So let's compare it to the debt ratio of the entire United States. The federal debt ratio. Well, that gives you a different picture. The debt of the United States government is over $18 billion, and the GDP last year of the United States was slightly over $17 billion. So the debt-to-deposit ratio, the gross domestic product-to-debt ratio of the United States is therefore about 105%, whereas Puerto Rico's is 70%. There's $58,000 of debt in the United States for every man, woman, and child per capita, 58,000, compared to about 20,000 for Puerto Rico. So if we were to compare those ratios, then the Puerto Rico should establish a financial control board over the U.S. economy, because the debt ratio and our management of debt in Puerto Rico has been much lower than it is in the United States. So a lot of these facts and figures are like President Harry Truman said, there's lies, damn lies, and then there's statistics. So what I believe needs to be looked at is this underlying relationship where even when we renegotiate this debt, which is going to have to be renegotiated, it can't just be paid out. The governor made that abundantly clear. Even after that's done, we have to install some measures to allow Puerto Rico to become at least to some extent economically self-sustaining, because this colonial relationship is no longer working for anyone. Now that the U.S. bondholders are not going to get paid their money back on the timely basis that they thought, now Puerto Rico matters. Well, now that it's that we've reached that level of visibility is precisely when Governor Padilla needs to make the Jones Act reform and getting a shipping industry a central core issue in the renegotiation of Puerto Rico's public debt.
You wrote a piece, Greece, Puerto Rico, and the IMF, and how Freddy Krueger will kill Puerto Rico. How will Freddy Krueger kill Puerto Rico?
you ask good questions, Ed. And thank you for asking that one. There's something called the Krueger Report, which was the basic public policy underpinning of Garcia Padilla's televised speech of four days ago. Garcia Padilla went on the airways. He spoke to the entire island of Puerto Rico over WAPA TV and explained that his debt was not going to be paid right away, and but there's certain additional austerity, additional is the operative word, austerity measures that needed to be considered. So he went on the airways saying that there needs to be a shared sacrifice and also some sort of compromise from the creditors, from the bondholders, from the hedge funds that are holding this public debt over Puerto Rico. But what he didn't say, and this is unfortunate, is that the policy underpinning, the thing that he's relied on, is called the Krueger Report. Principal author was a woman named Ann Krueger. There's two co-authors, Regit Pende, and I forget the name of the third. But a key thing to bear in mind here is that these three co-authors, Krueger and the other two, collectively have worked for the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, for 63 years. And Regit Pende, one of the co-authors, is currently the managing director of the European division of the IMF. So this is essentially an IMF document. Well, Howard, it happens to be the IMF that is holding the loan that Greece defaulted on Wednesday, and that has thrown the Greek economy into a tailspin. So a concern that I have is that the same people that have been willing to essentially kick the Greek economy into the toilet, the IMF, are the authors of the financial plan that Garcia Padilla is relying upon. And when you read it, it reads very differently from the speech that Garcia Padilla made. On my website, I gave an analysis of it. It's clear and unambiguous. To the Krueger plan's credit, it doesn't hide its agenda very well. If that was the intent, it certainly didn't do it. It calls for eliminating the minimum wage in Puerto Rico. I mean, con eso se dice todo. How much more further you need to go? Eliminating the minimum wage in Puerto Rico, reconsidering the issue of child labor. Just read it. I can even, if I have time while I'm speaking, I'll look up the page references. Reinstating another set of property taxes, lowering the number of teachers in Puerto Rico, and cutting all sorts of federal entitlements, welfare, housing subsidies, and Medicaid. Now, when you think that we're talking about renegotiating a public debt, a public debt, but to private creditors, meaning hedge funds and pensions and private, not the U.S. government. So what does cutting welfare and housing subsidies and any federal monies, what does that have to do with paying a debt that is not to the U.S. government but to private sources? So there's something a little bit rotten in there, and the reason I compared it to Freddy Krueger is because when you go to sleep is when Freddy Krueger kills you, right? Well, that's what I'm telling the island men. This is one Krueger report. If you don't, if the island goes to sleep, Freddy Krueger is gonna. It's once it's gonna get through with Greece, it's gonna go feast on Fajardo. People better be very conscious and open-eyed about what exactly this negotiation is that Garcia Padilla is going to engage in. I'll give you one example of where it could have permanent, long-term negative consequences for Puerto Rico. The Krueger report talks about quote-unquote public-private partnerships. And in Garcia Padilla's speech, he mentioned bridges, roads, and an airport as an example of public-private partnerships that have worked. Well, I'm going to read between the lines. You know this, but for the listeners, those entities that Garcia Padilla mentioned are the primary revenue-generating entities. I'll give you an example. I live near the George Washington Bridge. The George Washington Bridge is the busiest bridge in the world, in the world. It's got about 400,000 vehicles passing over it daily. Now, when you multiply that by, I think the toll is now something like $12, you're looking at close to $5 million in just pure revenue every day coming over the George Washington Bridge. And when you multiply that over a year, it adds up to about $1.5 billion in revenue from that bridge. And so that's a revenue generator. It's like a cash machine. So when Garcia Padilla talks about public-private partnerships, what he's talking about is selling off the pieces of the government that you know that make money and using that as collateral for paying off this debt. And that, in the long run, is only going to put Puerto Rico into a deeper hole. So we need to be careful about the way that he renegotiates his debt. In a way, it might seem like, oh, he's saving the day. But if we're not careful how he does it, if he doesn't do it with Jones Act reform, where, in fact, you put in a shipping industry into the island that can then generate revenue and jobs for everybody, and instead you do the quick and easy fix of just selling off yet another piece of the body of Puerto Rico in order to satisfy this debt, which the bondholders would love, because that's going to be permanent, easy money that's going to keep coming in. If he does that quick and easy negotiation, that's going to be worse for Puerto Rico. So we need to watch the Krueger report.
One of the things that you have Bill O'Reilly speaking about this and comparing it to Greece and very high-profile kinds of folks that ordinarily couldn't give a damn about Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans in general. Why should somebody that's not Puerto Rican care about the status of the island? Because let me make a comparison. It's probably not a good comparison, but I'll make it anyway. The uproar over Donald Trump and the way that there's been responses to the uproar over Donald Trump, and I guess people are, it's united some communities, at least Latino nationalities, and everybody's up in an uproar. Yeah, right here in the heart of the Northeast, you got Puerto Ricans and the island of Puerto Rico on the verge of being totally economically destroyed and bringing on a new wave of migration to the United States. And there seems to be almost a near silence other than to criticize the Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico as lazy and the public workers as wanting too many benefits. And what should a person who says, well, look, I have nothing to do with me. If those Puerto Ricans can't settle their stuff on the island, that's their business. I'm living in New York. I live in California. I live in Carolina. What would you tell those folks?
Well, so we've already discussed a little bit of, we put the public debt into context, showing that the debt to the, as a ratio of gross domestic product, is actually a lot lower than it is in the United States in the first place. We've also talked about the fact that Puerto Rico wants nothing more than to go forward in a self-sustaining, with some sort of economic base in Puerto Rico so that it can pay this and future debts. So we've already discussed that. So that's pretty much gives a lie to the fact that the Puerto Ricans are not thrifty or not industrious or enterprising enough. What people need to understand is that the Puerto Ricans are specifically denied the foundational tools with which to build their own economy. So you can't blame the victim in that respect. But you asked a good question as to, even in view of that, a person will say, so what? Why is that my problem? And that's understandable. We live in a society, especially with cell phones and text messaging and 60-inch movies, TV screens, where it's becoming increasingly difficult for people to be involved with let alone care about their next-door neighbor, literally, let alone an island that's 1,500 miles away in the ocean. So I understand that, and it's really out of sight, out of mind. And very often with Puerto Rico, the way it's gone is what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, but what happens in Puerto Rico never happened at all. That far off people's radar screens. There's a few reasons. Some are a matter of principle, which doesn't really, in all honesty, Howard, doesn't really get you very far in this world. But one is the practical one. The principled ones are, first...
Those are the ones I like.
I'm sorry?
The principled ones are the ones I like. Go ahead.
That's because you went to Yale. The principles is, one, that Puerto Ricans are Americans. There's 8 million of us. And so if you're willing to forswear and ignore 8 million of your own people, then you need to really look at yourself personally and to look at the society that is willing to turn a blind eye to that. In 1971, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee completely recalibrated the Americans' perceptions of Native Americans. We started to look at it differently, at them and their history differently. There's less than a million, if you look at the numbers, there's less than a million Native Americans. But they're a part of our history, a very big part. They were here. They were the original Americans. Numbers don't matter. It's the principle of the thing, and it's a very deep one. Well, in our case, it's a very big principle, too. And in our case, we also happen to have a heck of a lot more numbers. There's 8 million Puerto Ricans. 4.5 million of them are here in the United States. So there's the principle of the fact that we're Americans. Another one is the national, I hope it's not a national mythology, the United States has built itself as the leader of the free world. And it's got founding principles of government by the consent of the governed, and that all men and women are created equal. Well, if that's true, then we need to apply that to 8 million people called Puerto Ricans as well. They're not second-class citizens. They were declared citizens in time to fight at World War One in 1917 and in every war since then. So in point of view of what the U.S. Constitution is supposed to mean, what citizenship is supposed to mean, and what being a part of this leader of the free world, well, you know, you shouldn't be then maintaining a colony in Puerto Rico and specifically prohibiting it from developing its own industry and taking away its jobs, 50,000 of them in the case of shipping, and giving them to Jacksonville, Florida. So that's a matter of principle. But now we'll get to something that sometimes carries a day more convincingly, some practical concerns. Right now, there's hundreds of thousands of people that are wondering if their bond payments are going to be met. When Puerto Rico is unable to pay these $73 billion on the terms that are being dictated to it, now, all of a sudden, the United States has to pay attention, doesn't it? Now it becomes a practical reality. I saw something on New York One yesterday. They had a quick one-minute thing about a Puerto Rican economy, and they juxtaposed a young man named Andrew Padilla talking about these issues with some lady that was clear, from her accent, it was clear she's not Puerto Rican, but she was Hispanic, so you could tell that, but it was close enough. Right? But she represents the Wall Street line, and the Wall Street line is that, oh, these are mom-and-pop retail investors that need to be paid back. What she doesn't tell you is that the reason that we got to $73 billion is because of the brokerage fees and the commissions of the people that have been churning these accounts for the last 15 years and very happily rolling it over from one account to the next because it meant more commissions, probably for people like the woman that went on TV and talked about it last night. She calls it a mom-and-pop retail thing. Wall Street is not about mom-and-pop retail. It's about, they could care less, but they do care about their year-end bonuses, which are most often add up to more than $1 million per broker. So if we're talking about repaying that debt, it's not time to think about Wall Street's line. It's time to think about the reality of what's going on that island, because what they're trying to do is stick Puerto Rico with a debt on terms that shouldn't have existed in the first place. If you can't allow a person to walk and you take their legs away from them, stop complaining about the wheelchair that you give them and the payments on the little scooter that they have to run around on. So that's a second one. Another practical element and why people should pay attention to what's going on in Puerto Rico is because there's in the area of 1 million Puerto Ricans in Florida right now. There's about 700,000 of them in Orlando. And Florida is going to be a battleground state in next year's presidential election. And you can bet that they're going to be looking at the cabotage laws and how and the preference that's being given to 50,000 people in Jacksonville, Florida, at the expense of the entire island of Puerto Rico. It's no longer about Hillary Clinton or someone else going down to Puerto Rico for 1 week or 2 days, dancing some salsa, eating some rice and beans, and yelling, Que viva Puerto Rico. Because that's literally the way that they've been campaigning. Phoenix has been patronizing for over a century. Now there's some real clear, hard, hardcore issues. People are losing their jobs. People are leaving the island. People's lives are being changed, and families are being disrupted permanently. So this time, the presidential candidates better talk about the economic development of Puerto Rico and the cabotage law and the Jones Act reform and 50,000 jobs that are going to come from shipping when they do something about really letting Puerto Rico having some true economic development. And that's why the United States needs to be thinking about us.
Why hasn't President Obama, there were people starting out put together articles, they're saying President Obama tells Puerto Rico to drop dead. Obama administration seemed callous to some of the pleas. And then on the other side, Nelson, I've seen on Democracy Now, Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez, Congressman Gutierrez, Congressman Serrano, a whole plethora of the Puerto Rican political and business leadership make special pleas to Senator Schumer. And all of these things, for some reason, seem to be falling on deaf ears. Is that product of the fact that the community just doesn't have enough political juice to get these people, or is it that these people basically couldn't care less and Congress is going to make a commitment not to do anything and let Puerto Rico fall flat on its face?
It's a product of both. In a sense, to say one is almost synonymous with saying the other, that about a lack of juice and the fact that it's falling on deaf ears, because it's two sides of the same coin. It does fall on deaf ears. I'll give you an example. A lot of people may not be aware, but Senator John McCain recently, and he may have done it knowing that it was a non-starter or that it would be a one-house bill, and he was maybe doing it to placate some, either part of his constituency in Arizona or some funders of his campaign. He proposed a Jones Act reform bill that went nowhere because, as you said, it fell on deaf ears. And in fact, it specifically started to get some real pushback from the Jacksonville business press, because it's, you can see it online, that immediately the Jacksonville Chamber of Commerce and a couple of the business periodicals from Jacksonville started lobbying against it. What happens, as using that as an example, Jones Act reform to get some shipping in Puerto Rico, is you will get the unions in Jacksonville lobbying their Democratic congressmen. And the management, the owners of the four Jones Act carrier companies, Crowley, Horizon, SeaStar, they will lobby their Republican congressmen, because generally business owners deal with Republicans. So you will have a specific concentrated knot of congressional opponents opposing Jones Act reform. And with Citizens United, the FCC, you have all sorts of payment going over and under the table to those and other congressmen. Because there's big money involved, we're talking of billions of dollars a year that change hands because of the protection, the monopoly that the Jones Act is providing to these shippers into Puerto Rico. It's huge amounts of money. It's a rough situation, and it's one that people have to realize that then perhaps it's a Gordian knot that cannot be unraveled, and it has to be cut. If it is so intractable and if it's so unmanageable and something as logical, ethical, and powerful in terms of developing the Puerto Rican economy as to allow it to have its own shipping. It's an island, folks. On an island, you need to have shipping. If we can't even get that past the U.S. Congress, then maybe we really truly have a Gordian knot and it's time to consider cutting it and declaring that Puerto Rico needs to be independent.
That's a strong statement. I find, Nelson, it's an interesting dichotomy. I was talking with someone about this. We are constantly, you wrote a whole book explaining about the war on Puerto Ricans and explaining the various dimensions and the historical context of this. And the desire on part of most of our leadership, or much of the more important figures in our leadership, to sort of break away that island colonial relationship. On the other end, that same leadership, the nouveau leadership, now finds itself having to ask that same government that they want to tear away from, to sort of bail out the Puerto Rican economy. Are we moving into a schizophrenic stage where on one end we need the U.S. economy to keep us afloat, and on the other end we realize that they've given us nothing but pain and blood and Oscar Lopez Rivera in prison and a whole array of other things? Are we at mutual ends now? How do you view that?
You know, Howard, you really should be a law school professor because you're a master of the Socratic method. You present what is a really very complicated and very subtle rhetorical question, and you make it sound like and it is great because you gave me the answer. The answer, Howard, is that you're right.
Well, I like that part.
Said,
I like.
Yeah, because you just gave the answer, and I really appreciate it. I thank you for couching the question in those terms. Are we approaching a schizophrenic point? And the point is, Howard, I don't know if you're leading in that direction, is that it is a schizophrenic relationship that has existed from the beginning. To call it ELA, Estado Libre Asociado, a freely associated state, is almost definitionally, when you look at those three words, is oxymoronic. How can Puerto Rico be a freely associated state if it's not a state? And if it had really no freedom in the joining of it? That Commonwealth vote that was engineered in 1952 by Luis Muñoz Marín was a sham. How do we know it's a sham? Well, one way is that the architect of it, the guy in the back room who wrote it, was a man named Jorge Trias Monge, who also went to Yale, graduate of Yale Law School. He was also the attorney general whatever the term that they have for Puerto Rico. He was the attorney general of Puerto Rico, Muñoz Marín administration. And he is also the chief justice of the Supreme Court of Puerto Rico. His name is Jorge Trias Monge. And he was the principal architect and drafter of the Constitution, and he advocated for it in both in Washington and before the UN that became the Commonwealth's apparatus we now have. The devil was in the details, and he's the one that wrote them. Well, Jorge Trias Monge, just two or three years before he died, he wrote a few books. The last one was called Puerto Rico, the Last Colony in the World. Trials of a Last Colony. And it was published by Yale University Press. And it was all about that book. It goes on in great specific length as to why Puerto Rico, the Commonwealth, is just a thin veil for an underlying colonial relationship. That Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States. And its Commonwealth apparatus is just so much window dressing. Because as the United States has plenary jurisdiction over any law that's promulgated by the Puerto Rican legislature. The fact that right now we're talking about this public debt and that Washington says no bailout and turns its eye and ignores the fact that when you compare Puerto Rico to Detroit as an example, well, Detroit was given the opportunity to renegotiate its debt. But also what Detroit has is it's got the automobile industry. It's got an industry. It's got something. Puerto Rico has been specifically prohibited from having anything. And any industrial development that's occurred in Puerto Rico has been generally a sort of a 20-year tax abatement deal for foreign corporations, i.e. U.S. corporations, that then repatriate all their profits back into the United States corporate headquarters, leaving nothing behind in Puerto Rico. And then when that tax abatement deal ends, or when they can get cheaper labor in Malaysia or the Philippines or anywhere else, they just leave. They're gone and leaving nothing behind in Puerto Rico. So Puerto Rico is in a continuing chronic state of dependency. So what your question was, are we moving into this schizophrenic direction? And it was a beautiful question because it allowed me piece together this answer so that hopefully the listeners can see that we've been there all along. This schizophrenic relationship that has not worked was its programmed failure. The only reason now that people are seeing it is because suddenly it's ripened into a palpable figure, a $73 billion public debt. And so in a weird way, this public debt presents an opportunity. And hopefully the governor will take it that way. That opportunity is to not only renegotiate the debt, but renegotiate the underlying relationship that's created that debt. That is what has to happen, or else that debt, it's going to happen year after year, and it's never going to go away.
We often hear, at least much, a lot of the independent sector, and I've always found this interesting, Nelson, making appeals to the international community and international law. They just had the, what had become almost like the annual presentation between the, to the United Nations on the colonial status of the island. How effective is that strategy? And isn't it time for many of us who believe in Puerto Rican self-determination to start reconsidering strategies that don't seem to be having any impact? As one of the old guard, I've seen this constant turning around and appealing to international forums and basically having the same relationships and worsening relationships in Puerto Rico. And I think there has to be a serious discussion about among our leadership about where they want to take the status question on the island, particularly the Puerto Ricans in the United States who sort of get caught in the middle. Every time those of us who are here, there's an emergency, all of a sudden everybody from the state side has to go into emergency mode like they did two weeks ago with Senator Schumer getting together with the congressional delegation with 32 BJ, the unions, and Dennis Rivera, the labor leader, and all of us sitting down and trying to figure out any way to save this. Is it the fact that tactically some of our leadership is not, they're not willing to consider some of the more radical strategies? That if you continue to be coming or perceived of as beggars, don't you lose credibility or respect from those people in positions of influence?
You went through a few things in your question, and they were all very sensible. One thing you mentioned was the UN and that forum, the fact that there's a history here. And the history is really very clear. It's black and white. It's written down that in December 14, 1960, the UN promulgated a resolution, Resolution 1514. Sections 1 through 7 of that resolution specifically state that all non-self-governing territories should have the right of self-determination. And it's very specific about the conditions that create that right to self-determination and what, how you qualify for that. And Puerto Rico qualifies for every single one of them. So Puerto Rico had gone into a Chinese restaurant and ordered up exactly off the menu what it needed. There's a resolution 1514. It was like, it should have been called the Puerto Rico resolution. That was on December 14, 1960. Over the last 34 years, representatives from Puerto Rico from all different sectors have testified before the UN Decolonization Committee. And in each of those 34 years, the Decolonization Committee then issues a resolution in favor of the right to self-determination of Puerto Rico. It's so consistent with the terms of Resolution 1514, which I just discussed. So as you said, unfortunately, it becomes this yearly symbolic. And if it becomes symbolic or theatric, then you start thinking of the whole thing, and you start thinking La Lupe, her song, right? Teatro. Because yeah, that's what you're getting. And so at the end of what it's done, with each successive year, you build up more of a public record in favor of it. It seems a bit more farcical with each passing year. You say, well, wait a minute. Is the UN just sort of like a puppet, in this case at least, that each time you draw a line in the sand, you're saying, go ahead, cross that line, see what happens. And nothing happens. You know, it becomes kind of ridiculous. So that's part of the problem.
Maybe they should, some of our folks should stop worrying about whether Donald Trump has a golf course in the South Bronx or in the Bronx and worry about the realities of the Puerto Rican experience and the people of Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
And that is not to juxtapose forms of oppression, but sometimes I see our folks get overly enthusiastic about Trump in the Bronx and the golf course, and right here our people are catching hell with a new migration coming here, and they got nothing to say about that. You know, they're busy courting the very people that are treating them like they don't count.
Trump and what sad reaction that what happened to the after the Puerto Rican Day Parade, which was more substantive and had more issues and more texture to it this year, and it had less of a sort of a corporate feel this year, and yet, unfortunately, what happened then with that Daily News photo, but you saw how people reacted very quickly, forcefully, and effectively, and yet, as you say, at the end of the day, one is a parade and the other one is Donald Trump and his hairdo. And there's a meaningful, because they show that we exist and that we need to be taken into account. But they're not meaningful in terms of the underlying economics of our home country. And so I agree that that's always been a problem, that we, when you finally come down to it, when you finally come down to the rice and beans, dollars and cents of it, it always seems to be a Pax Americana, always on the terms of the Americans. In my view, Howard, to maybe just bring this into focus, the law of cabotage, the Jones Act reform, getting those 50,000 jobs into Puerto Rico, I believe that Jones Act reform should be the new Vieques. 2 days ago, the New York Times, by the way, agreed. The New York Times op-ed editorial board, their masthead editorial, specifically enunciated that we need to have Jones Act reform and allow those carrier ships to function in Puerto Rico and to jumpstart the Puerto Rican economy. It, just look it up. Just look up New York Times, Jones Act. You'll see it 2 days ago. We have some ammunition in this thing. We're not alone in the way that we've been in the past. If we have this looming public debt, and the New York Times is in favor of Jones Act reform, and even the Krueger report, even Freddy Krueger announced it, I think it was on page 8. Just look up the Krueger report, Puerto Rico, and then look at page 8. You'll see it. It has a whole paragraph on the importance of Jones Act reform for reviving the economy of Puerto Rico. So that's what I think we can do. We can marshal our resources and circle the wagons around the cabotage law and make that our new Vieques, and that will have a real impact in the Puerto Rican economy.
Where can people reach you, Nelson?
That is a good way. I look at it every day, and that is waragainstallpuertoricans.com, and also through Facebook. My name is Nelson Dennis, but the website discusses these issues every day. In fact, in the blog today, for instance, there's a big blog analysis on the Jones Act reform. Waragainstallpuertoricans.com is a way to have a dialogue with me and about these issues.
Okay, thank you very much, Nelson Dennis. As usual, outstanding analysis. We got to do more follow-up, and we got to learn to close rank. I think very much our people very much get disrespected, and it's time to get a much stronger front within our own community to combat these things. I think sometimes we're a little bit too into the ay bendito. And maybe that is a product of colonialism, this unwillingness to take on and be direct about things that you want. It has to be a more radical approach, in my judgment, to the realities of Puerto Rican colonialism. If not, we're going to be in this circular firing squad for many, many years. Thank you very much, Nelson Dennis. I'll catch you on the next wave on the Jordan Journal.
Yo sé que no te gustó. Yo planteo.